Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Play Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 41 of Nerd Pride Radio. 41, it's a prime number. Good lord, in fact, it's the primiest of prime numbers. Look at Wikipedia, and 41 is a prime, a twin prime, a super singular prime, which of course means it's a Chen prime. It's a Sophie Germain prime, and in fact, a Sophie Germain prime that starts a Cunningham chain. It's a Newman Shanks Williams prime, a Proth prime. Holy crap, I don't even know what any of those words mean, but it sounds important, right? So ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome! My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, a computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, gaming nerd, science nerd. Plus, there's like seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my skull anymore. As always, you're listening to the best-smelling podcast on the internet. That's right, Nerd Pride Radio smells like Mountain Dew and Cheetos. Whew! But let's get right into the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This, of course, is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list. And then the best stuff gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. So, straight into that master list. Oh, guess what? We've got yet another installment in our all-too-frequent segment, Mike Was Wrong! Yeah, and actually, I'm wrong twice. First off, my brother had to point out to me that apparently it was Zombie who had Michael Jackson on his Deadpool list and got the massive number of points for it, not my wife, as I claimed in last episode. So I apologize for that. And then secondly, as I was talking about kick-ass dwarves from The Hobbit, I think I may have said that the most kick-ass of all dwarves was Balin, and if I did say that, I really apologize, because Balin was the old dude, and the one I was looking at was Dwalin, who is his brother, and therefore, I was wrong. So, again, my apologies. You know how I am. More than that, though, I've got updates. Speaking of that Deadpool, Nerd Pride Deadpool 2013, holy crap, Dear Abby died. Can you believe it? Yeah, Abigail Van Buren, whatever her name is, Pauline? Yeah, is that her real name? Pauline something or other? Oh, man, I should have looked this up before I started. Anyway, Dear Abby passed away at the age of 94, which means that my brother now has 6 points and the lead. So, of course, you know, we've still got George Bush Sr. on the ropes right now, in which case that would be yet more points for my brother. Also, Hugo Chavez is in Cuba for surgery, and they've been debating, and I haven't followed up. This is like a week ago I heard it, but they've been debating. Since he's so sick and can't make it back, he's been reelected but can't get there for the inauguration. Can they, in fact, inaugurate him? Can he still be president even though he's ill and out of country? And I think the answer is yes, he can. But either way, Hugo Chavez not doing all that great. So that is a potential 42 points for Yancey. Oh, I told you this was morbid, and yet you can't help yourself sometimes. But you know what I'm most excited about this week? That's right, yet another installment of our Nerd Pride book report. Okay, and I had some trouble trying to decide where to place this in the show, and finally decided that since what I'm going to be looking at here are actual graphic novels, well, one of them is a comic book, but graphic novels, is there a difference? Either way, figured I'd put it under the book report. I saw an article on IO9 telling me to go check out the Trekker comic. And apparently Trekker was a comic published by Dark Horse back in the 1980s. But now the author and artist, Ron Randall, has begun publishing these. He's been doing it for the last 2 years. He's publishing one page a week. And now he's got like 11 issues of the old Trekker comic now posted online. And the article in IO9 absolutely raved about it, and of course I do whatever IO9 tells me. And so I went and I checked out the Trekker comic, which you can find at trekkercomic.com. And Trekker is, and this is their description straight off the site, chronicling the life and times of 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair. Okay. And it is exactly that. Mercy St. Clair is an uber hot bounty hunter on some foreign planet in the 23rd century. And the thing that gets me about this comic is it is so 80s, it is unbelievable. It is, now again, and I mentioned that Mercy St. Clair is uber hot, and she really is, but in such an 80s way, which, by the way, I totally go for. This is such a throwback to the comics I read as a kid. And it's not bad stories. There's a couple of weak comics in there. There's a couple of strong ones, but it's a very typical 80s-style comic, and it's some decent science fiction, and it's just good adventure stuff. I mean, you know, most things, you know, they play with some, you know, she's got some existential doubt going on about the meaning of good and evil and working within the law and outside the law, and is this really, you know, they build up a lot of that, but also most problems are solved by shooting stuff. And so it is full-on action, beginning to end, and it's good. It's fun. From Ron Randall's website, at where I'm reading Trekker, the comic book, he has a link to other comics that he likes, and one of them that he recommended was a comic called Family Man. Family Man is a graphic novel being published online by a woman named Dylan McInnes. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. And you can find Family Man at lutherlevy.com, lutherlevy.com. And then also follow through to Dylan's other stuff. She has a really short online graphic novel called Outfoxed. She has another much longer-running comic that she's been doing, kind of a historical vampire farce called Bite Me. And she's really good. All of her stuff is really, really good. And Family Man, the thing that intrigued me and the reason I went to look at it is that when Ron Randall recommended, he said, hey, if you're willing to invest some time in something that takes kind of a slow build-up, I mean, you got to get into it. He said, Family Man is worth your time. And so I did. And sure enough, the thing opens up with a quote about wolves and some kind of hints that maybe there's something supernatural going on here. I mean, you immediately, from the opening quote, you immediately suspect that this is some sort of werewolf story. Well, if it is, dude, the build-up is a long way coming. What it turns out that this comic is about is about Luther Levy, who is half Jewish, half Protestant, and he is an educator, a philosopher, and he lives in 18th century France, Europe, somewhere. Anyway, it's somewhere in Europe. I think it's actually Eastern Germany. But it doesn't make any difference. It is an incredible story. It is so worth your time. It is, I mean, literally, it's this dude who has some philosophical differences with his old school. He's got problems with religion, with God, with all this stuff. And he winds up getting a job in an odd location. And he takes it. And the people there are fascinating. And his interactions with them are fascinating, and the whole thing had me absolutely hypnotized. I read, there's, I think, 200 and some pages of this graphic novel available online right now. I read all of them in a single sitting. I couldn't stop. I could not put this thing down. I don't want to give away anything about it, because it's so worth your time. So worth your time. Go look at it. And the only problem with it now is that she only puts out one new page every week. Therefore, every Friday is when I get my new installment. And sometimes, I mean, it's a graphic novel, so sometimes the new page is nothing but a single panel. Sometimes it's just a single full-page panel of art with almost no dialogue whatsoever. Sometimes it's a standard, you know, graphic novel page, and you get all sorts of dialogue, and you really advance the story, but sometimes you don't, and it's just killing me. A page a week? I don't know if I can handle this. I may have to put it away for a while and then come back in like 6 months and just read them all as a chunk. I don't know if I can handle this pace. It's driving me crazy. But LutherLevy.com, can't recommend this enough. Now, here's the thing. As I'm flipping around through Dylan Mikonas' website and then all of her other comics, and I'm just reading everything I can find by her because I'm just so fascinated. She, in her list of links to other comics, recommends a whole bunch of other artists and other comics. And the only one that caught my eye is one called Dicebox, because it's got dice in the name. So that's the reason I started looking at it in the first place. Dicebox, and it was clearly a science fiction thing. And, you know, if you know me and you know the stuff that I've worked on, I have an entire science fiction gaming setting called God's Dice I created, based on Einstein's quote that God does not play dice with the universe. And so I created a setting called God's Dice. And to me, a science fiction setting called Dicebox, it felt familiar. So I go and looking to see what this thing is. Now, here's the description of Dicebox from its own website. Dicebox, an online graphic novel by Jen Manley Lee, tells the story of an eventful year in the lives of Griffin and Molly, a couple of itinerant factory workers in a space-traveling future. All right, does that hook you yet? All right, because it did me. And I start reading, and Griffin and Molly are two women who, again, itinerant factory workers. They are, for the most part, mostly homeless most of the time, and they travel to wherever the work is. And so they wind up traveling from region to region on this planet, or if they can get a lift somewhere, they travel to other planets where the work is, and then they do all this really high-tech, space-age migrant farm work is essentially what they're doing, and how they live their lives, and how people interact, and how this government is structured, and what it does to its people. The whole thing is absolutely, absolutely mesmerizing. The world is unbelievably well-developed. And just hypnotic. And again, I couldn't put the thing down. And it took me probably 3 or 4 days because there's a lot of stuff there. She's finished book one. There's going to be, according to the author, there's going to be 4 books to this. And so she's finished book one, and I read all the way through all of that. And then there are the first couple of chapters of book two available. And now she only puts up, again, like Family Man, only puts up 1 or 2 new pages a week. And so, oh, God, I'm just killing. And this one, I don't think I can set aside and wait for the whole thing to read all at once because I'm so hooked on Dicebox that I have to go and check twice a week and make sure I'm getting my new pages. I cannot turn away from this thing. And here is what was really interesting for me. I have absorbed all three of these comics, Trekker, Family Man, and now Dicebox, and I've absorbed all three of them in the space of about a week and a half. And the really interesting part to me was the comparison where I started with Trekker as a very classic 80s sort of comic to Dicebox, which is a much more modern, obviously, piece of work in a very different style. And what I'm finding is Trekker, I'm still reading it. I mean, as the new pages come up, I'm still reading, but I may have to set it aside ultimately because Trekker is so incredibly sexist, it's really hard to deal with. I mean, the hero is a strong, tough female character, and she has depth, and she has skill, and she is very empowered, but empowered in a 1986 sort of way, if you know what I mean. She's still very much like watching Black Widow in Avengers promo material or in the Avengers movie. A lot of what she does, I mean, it's hard to find panels in Trekker where she is not posed to highlight her tits and ass. It's just, I mean, you know, she's got that beautiful face with these perfect pouty lips, and she's got this huge rack and this great ass, and every single shot seems to, in some way, pose her, highlight her, so that those assets are on display at all times. And Jeff Hawes has always complained about this in modern superhero comics, that they objectify women and that he can't read them because they're so exaggerated and so sexist in general. And I've always kind of poo-pooed that, and I've kind of, you know, yeah, whatever, that's just the way the media works, and it's just, you know, it's comics. You take what you get. But this Trekker comic really highlighted that for me because I had Dicebox right next to it, and I was actually reading the two kind of simultaneously for a while. And Dicebox and Family Man, for that matter, these two, as graphic novels with women authors, they have all sorts of adult content, and there is some, you know, just in-your-face sexuality, and there's straight-up nudity in both of these comics that, you know, Trekker is written as an 80s, you know, Dark Horse piece where, you know, there's sex involved and there's violence, but the sex is mostly implied or undercovers, or you're not getting anything revealing, whereas Dicebox just puts the nudity straight out front. But doesn't even, it's not like it makes a big deal about it, and it's just that the story of Dicebox is mostly about women. There are male characters in it, but most of the main movers in this story are female, and the sexuality is there, but it's not, you know, it's not, it's matter of fact. It's not titillating in the same sort of way that Trekker tries to be. You know what I mean? It just, I can't recommend these comics enough, honestly. Go check out Dicebox, dicebox.com. I think it's .com. Maybe it's .net. I'm pretty sure it's .com. Anyway, check out Dicebox. Check out everything that Dylan McConis has done. You will not be sorry. And then, again, if you want to throw back to the 80s style action comics, go read Trekker, trekkercomic.com. Good stuff. I am just enthralled. These are absolutely wonderful new finds. And here's the worst part, is that Family Man and Dicebox especially have on their side panels long lists of other comics that I may want to check out. And I'm afraid to do it because I've realized that there's this huge wealth of reading material out there. And I don't want to get hooked on any of them again. I need to kind of get caught up on some other stuff. I need to work harder on this podcast. I need to focus on the website. I need to focus on my family. I've got other things I need to do. And man, each one of these that I hit is like, I couldn't put it down. Could not stop reading. And so, I'm sure there's tons of other great stuff. And I'm sure someone is going to start a thread or write to me or do something and explain to me all these other wonderful comics in the same vein that I really ought to be checking out. And, man, not yet, but soon. And of course, as I get the, I'll bring them to you guys. That's what I do. And now it's time to visit my gaming table. I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die. That's right. Role-playing games, video games, card games. If it fits on my gaming table, then I'm here to share it with you. And now this is actually a entry I got for the Podomatic. And when I read it, I realized that there was so much material there that I really just wanted to turn it into its own piece. I got from Brasky a note that says simply that the entry was just top 5 paranoia deaths. That is fascinating to me. You guys know how much I love paranoia. It is paranoid gaming in a darkly humorous future. I've talked about paranoia many times, so I'll do a quick summary because I'm sure all of you already know what paranoia is. But it is a role-playing game set in the future where the crazy computer runs everything, and you guys are just trying to survive the day while accomplishing missions for your secret societies. And there's lots of backstabbing and lots of intrigue, and the whole thing is played out, at least the way we play it, as a comedy farce. And since everyone has 6 clones, when you die, a new clone is just issued. So you can die up to 6 times every game. And so death is dirt cheap and happens all the time, and usually in spectacular and funny ways. And so when Brasky asks me the top 5 paranoia deaths, I immediately started doing some research, because I thought I knew my favorites right off. But I started doing some research, and it turns out that the first online paranoia game that we played, I actually summarized that thing by putting in an appendix, Appendix B, called Faces of Death. And in Faces of Death, I literally went through, and for each character that was out there, I just numbered the clones 1 through 6 and went through how each of them died through the course of the game. So, for example, Christoph. Christoph, number 1, his heart was torn out and eaten by sore throat. Sore throat being the evil mutant that shows up and just dishes out the wrath of the GM whenever I was feeling particularly nasty. So heart torn out and eaten by sore throat. Christoph number 2, suffocated by his own regenerative tissue. Christoph number 3, this is where it gets funny for me. Christoph number 3, beheaded by Mori and then revived on a three-headed body and squished by a falling 800-pound bailiff bot. Okay, now, Christoph number 4, well, see Christoph 3. Christoph number 5, yeah, see Christoph 3 again. And then number 6, he was executed by the Mark IV at the very end of the mission. This is the kind of stuff that, that one, I love that one. Because Christoph, yeah, quite literally, and I have no idea why, for a while he had two versions of himself running around. Eventually, Mori, who was played by my cousin Rob Logic, Rob went and cut the heads off of two of the dead clones and then decided to sew them all together to make a three-headed Christoph clone. I have no idea why he did that, but it was really funny until, of course, the 800-pound bailiff bot fell from the ceiling and crushed them to death. Or, even better, my brother Kyle, he played Mick Harthy. And Mick number 1, he hulked out and got shot by everybody in the hall. Mick number 2, set on fire by a registered mutant for posing as sore throat. Mick number 3, hulked out and got shot by everybody in PLC. Mick 4, killed by the Mark IV for crossing the yellow line. Mick 5, now this is my favorite one, and I've described this one on the show before, lasered when the Mark IV misunderstood his request for mood lighting. And again, this is the problem with all of these, is they take so much explanation, and I wanted to do this as kind of a quick segment. But again, he had gone and taken Mikey, who was a light bot. Mikey's entire job was to provide light for people. And when the team accidentally fried the Mark IV's brain, the Mark IV being a building-sized tank that clearly did not need any protection, and yet the team's entire mission was to protect the Mark IV from spies, saboteurs, whatever. They accidentally, in the course of guarding the Mark IV, accidentally destroyed its brain. And so my brother, thinking he was very clever, Mick, he decided that he was going to go in and replace the Mark IV's brain with the brain of Mikey the Lightbot, because, well, that was the bot brain that he had laying around, and it seemed to work. And so then, to show off, he shows up and he wants to take a dramatic moment, and he turns to the Mark IV and he says, "Yeah, Mikey, can I get a little mood lighting over here?" And Mikey, thrilled to death to be able to help, focuses every laser on the damn machine onto my brother and fries the crap out of him, blows a huge crater in the ground. The guy was vaporized instantly. And Mikey was just trying to help. So that was probably one of my very favoriteest deaths of all time, is watching that one. Other ones, see, I wish I could get a full top five, but I went through some of the other games, and damn, now I'm wishing I had gone through and done this whole appendix, Faces of Death, so I could get a nice quick summary. Because a lot of them, I don't even remember how everyone died. I remember there were lots of gruesome moments, and I remember lots of gruesome deaths. But man, it's hard to sort one from the other and remember which game was which. But my other favoriteest death of all time, after the mood lighting bit, was, and this is the example I use, by the way, when someone wants to know what paranoia is like, when I'm trying to explain it to people who aren't that familiar with role-playing and certainly aren't familiar with paranoia, I almost always give them this example that, again, my brother, hold on, I'm going to wait for this train to pass. All right, anyway, I don't even know what just happened there. I was waiting for the train, and I realized that, oh crap, a whole bunch of static's been introduced into the feed while I was talking about Faces of Death, and I don't know how far back it went. Hopefully it all cleans up well, but anyway, it seems to be gone now, so we'll go ahead and try again. Anyway, the death that, again, this is the one I used to explain to other people how paranoia works. My brother had been playing a character in our game Whitewash, which was probably my favorite game of paranoia we've ever played. It was something in the air that we played, and we got done with the entire thing in probably 3 months playing solely through email. I mean, it was huge, fast-paced, and tons of fun, and we got it done super quick. And at the beginning of the game, my brother had gone to PLC, Production Logistics and Commissary. It's the supply warehouse. And so he goes there, and he makes a request for all the stuff he thinks he's going to need for this mission. And he's requesting bizarre things. He's requesting, he wants confetti grenades, and he specifies that they have to look like regular grenades, but when they explode, boom, it goes up in a burst of confetti. He wanted a thought bubble, basically a floating glass thought bubble that follows him around, and then when he thinks of certain things, he can make them appear in the bubble behind him. He asked for all sorts of bizarre things, and most of them were things that, A, didn't exist, and B, even if they did, no way were they going to issue these things to him. And so I figured it would be really funny if the guys at the warehouse just handed him whatever was the closest item to whatever he asked for. And so specifically, he asked for confetti grenades, and so they just gave him a box full of grenades. And so he just assumed they were full of confetti. You can see where the humor is going to come out of this. And so at some point in the game, he gets killed. All right, but it's a slow death, and as he's dying, he specifies that he wants to pull out one of his confetti grenades, pull the pin, and then roll over on it so that when he dies, he is laying on it. It is held shut by the weight of his body. And then that way, the minute anyone comes over to examine his body, they're going to roll him over, and then poof, confetti! See how funny that's going to be? Oh, he was so thrilled. And of course, what happens is he dies. He lays there. Then my wife's character comes over to take a look. She rolls the body over to make sure that he's dead, and then boom, grenade, now they're both super dead. And we all had a huge laugh, except my wife, who was so pissed, because of course she assumes that my brother was a weasel who would do that on purpose and booby-trap his own body, not realizing it was supposed to be fun. And so that set up a rivalry that went on for half the game. I loved playing that. One of my favorite deaths. And then I'm trying to look through the list here quick. I don't want to bore you guys just by ticking them all off one at a time. But I'm trying to see if there's any other good ones in the lists that I do have. But most of them are funny. But as it turns out, I'm looking through the list and I realized that whole thing with the train, and then you guys don't know it, but I had the whole thing on pause for about 15 minutes while I'm sitting here searching for the static, and I feel like I've kind of lost my momentum on this particular segment. So you know what? As much as I love paranoia deaths, I'm gonna let this one end here, and we're just gonna move on to my next segment because I got a lot more good stuff ahead of us. In fact, I think we should head right into a nerd culture report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
No, Gonzo, but you're very, very close. This is my nerd culture report for the week, and as it turns out, nerd culture is, as I've mentioned before, pervasive. We're everywhere. It's almost, nerds are so mainstream that it's almost too much for me to claim that we're some kind of little niche culture and that we're some kind of oppressed group. We still are in our own ways, but really we are so mainstream. This one came from Jeff Hawes. Jeff Hawes sent it to me, and it was so absolutely beautiful. I had to share it with you guys. Back on January 3rd, which for me was, almost 3 weeks ago now? Back on January 3rd, William Shatner, the William Shatner, tweeted to Chris Hadfield, and he said, "Are you tweeting from space?" And as it turns out, Commander Chris Hadfield, an engineer on the International Space Station, was in fact tweeting from space, and so Commander Hadfield's reply was, "Yes, standard orbit, Captain, and we're detecting signs of life on the surface." How awesome is that? I laughed my ass off. I think that's awesome. Just the guy, I mean, again, you know, yes, he is a nerd sort of hero because, you know, he's a rocket scientist and engineer and astronaut and he's up in space and all that. So you could imagine that he's maybe shown an interest in Star Trek in his life. But the fact that William Shatner, with our technology today, William Shatner sends a tweet to this dude, and the guy responds back immediately with a beautiful Star Trek reference. I thrilled to death. All right, but then Jeff sent me that one and said I should share. But on top of that, I then, like just a couple of days later, and you guys, a lot of you have seen this because it's been getting passed around the internet all over the place, but apparently there was a petition on the White House website to come up with the funding to construct a Death Star. Yeah, because, you know, people have nothing better to do with their internet resources than petition the White House for a Death Star. And that petition wound up hitting 25,000 signatures because, well, who doesn't want a Death Star, right? And so the White House assigned a dude, Paul Shawcross. And Paul Shawcross is the guy tasked with giving an official response to the request for a Death Star. All right, this is how the White House is using its resources because, hey, it's got 25,000 signatures. We got to tell them something. And clearly, are we going to build a Death Star? Well, let's find out what Mr. Shawcross tells us. In the official reason, I'm not going to read the entire thing because it's actually very long. But he opens up with, "The administration shares your desire for job creation and a strong national defense, but a Death Star isn't on the horizon. Here are a few reasons." The construction of the Death Star has been estimated to cost more than $850 quadrillion. We're working hard to reduce the deficit, not expand it. Secondly, the administration does not support blowing up planets. Good to know. Thirdly, why would we spend countless taxpayer dollars on one Death Star with a fundamental flaw that can be exploited by a one-man starship? See, this guy did his homework. Now, I like to think that Paul Shawcross was a nerd from the get-go, and that's why he got this assignment in the first place, that they're kicking it around the office and they're saying, "Yeah, dudes, all right, we got to come up with an official response." And Paul says, "Dude, me, I got this one. Trust me on this. I can do this." Because he did. All right, and he goes on in this vein for a long time. All right, he goes bragging up the accomplishments of the American space program, right, mentioning the great things about the International Space Station, how much we've put into it, where our space program is going. He mentions that we have two robot science labs, one wielding a laser, as I pointed out, roving around the planet Mars. I mean, he goes on and on like this, making our current accomplishments sound very, very dramatic, which they actually are. I mean, we kind of take it for granted. But he even mentions, you know, the Hubble Space Telescope and brings up the James Webb Space Telescope, which I am so looking forward to. Goes on and on like this for a while. And then here's how he decides to wrap it all up. He says, "We don't have a Death Star, but we do have floating robot assistants on the space station, a president who knows his way around a lightsaber and advanced marshmallow cannons, and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is supporting research on building Luke's arm, floating droids, and quadruped walkers. We are living in the future. Enjoy it." All right. Now, he hasn't finished yet, but this is the tone, is that, dude, we live in an awesome world as it is. I mean, great, yeah, Death Star, we know you guys are making a big old joke and all this, but look at all the stuff we have, all right? And then goes into encouraging people that, look, this is real careers. This is something that you can do. You can help us advance this stuff. It's all very hopeful and very forward-thinking. And so he ends with, "If you do pursue a career in science, technology, engineering, or math-related fields, the Force will be with us. Remember, the Death Star's power to destroy a planet or even a whole star system is insignificant next to the power of the Force." Well, that is awesome. All right. This, again, there's a lot more to it. I encourage you to go find it and read it. It's easy to find. All right. The White House response to the Death Star proposal. But this was exactly the right tone. And dude, it is so true. This is what tickles me about it is yeah, they're taking what's a joke and they're responding with, you know, insider references and in good geek terminology and all this. But they also make a really valuable point that, dude, we're doing awesome stuff. We're doing awesome stuff, and it's wide open. Who knows where we're going from here, and everybody can be a part of it. I mean, seriously, is this not a call for nerds to unite? This is awesome. But again, both of these, William Shatner tweeting to the International Space Station and this whole petition thing, just goes to show you exactly how mainstream nerd culture really, really is. A theme which, again, I started off Nerd Pride Radio as with kind of the idea that, you know, this is a home for nerds. This is a home for people who are a little outside the mainstream, a little bit. But the more I look at it, the more I realize that, God, mainstream society is really, really absorbing a lot of what it is that we do or what we use to identify ourselves with. Kind of leaves me with a bit of a nerd identity crisis. You know what I mean? But enough of my maudlin meandering. What's up next?
And now for something completely different.
Yeah, exactly. Just some stuff that I don't really have a category for yet. And what is it on this week's completely different? Food loaf. I love the concept of food loaf. Also known as prison loaf, and also has about a dozen other names. Food loaf is a concept that Sirius Paul explained to me probably a dozen years ago, and I have always been fascinated by the idea. There are certain people who are in prison who, for whatever reason, can't be trusted with a tray and utensils. Generally can't be trusted because, you know, they like to break them, destroy things with them, turn them into weapons, for whatever reason. So, if you can't be trusted with a tray and utensils for food time in prison, you get food loaf. Now, there are recipes for food loaf. There are actually some places that have a standardized food loaf recipe that they actually have base ingredients and they throw them all together, and so your food loaf is exactly the same every time. But the way Paul originally explained it, and this is the way a lot of prisons do it, is you get whatever your meal is dumped into a food processor. So if it's going to be breakfast, they take your toast, your eggs, your bacon, your coffee, your orange juice, everything that goes with this breakfast, and they dump it all in the food processor, and they blend it until they get a nice, nice, consistent consistency. It is nice and well-blended, homogeneous. All right. And then they take that mixture, whatever went into it, and they dump it into a bread pan, and then they throw it into the oven until it is of a bread-like consistency, or at least a consistency that is appropriate for eating. And there you go. That's your whole meal. And then they generally serve it to you on a paper towel, because you're not making a shiv out of a paper towel. All right. This has been denounced as cruel and unusual punishment. Specifically, there are certain states that prohibit the use of food as a punishment. And so there are some states where using food loaf or prison loaf is illegal. Now, me personally, and the argument to be made, and I completely agree with this 100%, is this is not a punishment. This is a natural consequence. If every time we give you a tray, like in solitary confinement, for example, you spend your time destroying that tray, using it for nefarious purposes, doing whatever you're going to do with it. If you can't be trusted with a damn spork, for God's sake, then we still need to give you nutrition. We just need to give it to you in a form that you can use without giving you these implements that you are now destroying, causing problems with, etc., etc. And in general, look, food loaf lasts like a week, and then most people, once they've been on food loaf, are very happy to do whatever it takes to not be on food loaf ever again. That makes perfect sense. And so I saw food loaf in the news. This is what reminded me of it. I saw food loaf in the news, and so I decided to do a little bit of research on food loaf because I'm really, really curious what food loaf tastes like. You know what I mean? And what I found was, I found a place where government officials in different areas had gone out and tried food loaf, that, okay, if we're going to make a judgment on whether this is cruel or unusual, or if we're going to, you know, we're being asked to pass laws in relation to its use, whatever, we should try it ourselves. We should actually know what it is that we're passing judgment on. And they have some interesting comments on it. But more interesting is the dude, and I wish I had written his name down. He is a professional restaurant reviewer. He's a critic. And he decided that he would go out, because the controversy was going on, he would go out and get himself some food loaf, and he would eat the whole thing. He'd go through the food loaf experience, and then he'd write up a review for it as if he was reviewing any restaurant. And it was awesome. All right? And his comments actually jibed pretty well with what the other people who had tried it said when they went into it. And he said the worst part about it is you would expect that it's going to taste awful, because that's what I expect, is that food loaf sounds like something absolutely horrible. He says, no. He said something about it, because they're not adding any extra spices, there's no salt, there's no anything extra added into it. It's just the basics of your meal, nothing else added, blended, baked. And he said somehow that magically cancels out all flavor. He said it is amazing because, one, he said first thing when he breaks it open, he was amazed at the absolute uniformity of the consistency. He was expecting to see, you know, the little pieces of the carrots or the little chunks of whatever, or, you know, something that, you know, like a good rough bread. He says, no, it's just, I mean, it is absolutely uniform in the color, not appetizing whatsoever. I think his was a little bit on the pinkish side when it was all done. So he says, absolutely unappetizing in appearance. He said, but then he goes to taste it, and again, it seems like somehow magically all flavor canceled each other out, and he said it tasted like nothing. Absolutely bizarre. Tasted like nothing. And so now my first response to that, like a lot of you, is I'm thinking, okay, then, if it's not going to be unpleasant, then, okay, bland. I can deal with bland. You can get through that for a week, right? He says, no. He said it was horrifying. He says it was absolutely horrifying because as he's eating it, he understands what's in it. He knows all of the ingredients. He understands that this is 1,000 calories worth of nutrition and it is perfectly balanced. It will give him everything he needs to get him through the day. He says, but without the flavor, he said his brain was still telling him that he needed food. He said there was nothing coming off of food loaf, nothing at all, that gave his body all the telltale signs and signals that you're eating something, that you're satisfying your hunger, that you're actually doing something good for your body. He said it was weird that even as he's getting to the end of it, and now he's full enough that, I mean, he can tell that he's extremely full on food loaf. I mean, he can feel it. His stomach is tightening up. He knows he's done eating. And yet, he said, his brain was still screaming that he needed to go find real food, that he needed to go eat something nutritious, something even though he knows it's nutritious. His body was telling him that nope, he might as well have been eating paper. Might as well have been cardboard. There was nothing in there that would satisfy him. And so he said it is the single most unsatisfying meal he has ever had, ever. I thought that was fascinating. So what it all comes down to, having taken all of this information in, and again, the officials that tried it, the government officials who went and tasted food loaf, said much of the same thing. Some of them said that they didn't care much for the taste, but a lot of them said, yeah, it just doesn't taste like anything. It's just terribly unpleasant because there's nothing to it. So at this point now, I mean, don't you want to try it? Don't you? I mean, I don't want to go subsist on it for a week or anything. I'm not trying to prove any kind of a point, but makes you want to head on over to the local prison and ask them, can I try some food loaf? I'm just curious. Just to be, and not, I don't think they'd do it. Or then I understand, I could probably, I mean, the recipes aren't that tough. I could probably do this at home with some of their standardized recipes and make myself some food loaf. I don't think I'm willing to go to that kind of length, actually spend a little money on it and all that time. But man, there's a really, really curious part of me that really just wants to try it just once, just to see what happens, just to see what it's like. But maybe someday in the future, I hope I don't ever have to try it. Whatever gods of karma are out there listening in on this podcast, for God's sake, don't send me to prison just so I can get this one wish, all right? I gave the monkey's paw away. I did nothing. I swear. Nothing. All right, it tells me now that I'm an hour into this thing, and that may or may not be true because I dicked around a lot earlier, so I've got a lot of dead air in there. But wherever I am, it's time for the badass movie quote of the week. This one is one of my favorite sci-fi movies. One of my favorite characters from said sci-fi movie, and it is, I'll just give you the quote first, quote, hell, I'll kill a man in a fair fight, or if I think he's going to start a fair fight, or if he bothers me, or if there's a woman, or if I'm getting paid, mostly only when I'm getting paid, end quote. And that, of course, is Adam Baldwin as Jane from the movie Serenity. All right, I love Serenity. I love Firefly. You guys know that. You guys all agree with me. I just think that's an awesome quote. Totally, totally Jane. Absolutely love it. Which means that all that's left is the Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. Where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, I'm so glad you asked that question because that is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Then send your question or your topic to me by email or screw the email. Better yet, send it to me in a private message on our forums and I will add it to my Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be, and R2 has given me our first number, which is 13. 13 comes from Brasky, and Brasky says, I feel like the ecology and evolutionary needs of the wild leprechaun are simply illogical. What's with the hiding of the pot of gold? Why is that important? And if it's so secret, then what's with the rainbows? Seems like natural selection would eliminate the use of rainbows. Mr. Brasky, you make an excellent point. And I would like to point out that, by the way, there are no leprechauns left. Probably for exactly this reason. That, if I understand correctly, why the rainbows in the first place? I believe, and this is just the leading theory, because obviously there's no wild leprechauns left, so therefore it's really difficult to study. But the assumption, of course, is that the rainbow and the pot of gold itself, but especially the rainbow, was more of a mating display. The pot of gold itself, it's like the nesting in birds and fish and other animals that will create a very elaborate nest, in this case, the pot of gold, to lure in the wood nymphs, the sylphs, the dryads, all the others, because, dude, those chicks are hot and competition is fierce. And so therefore, you need the elaborate nest and then, of course, the showy rainbow display to lure in the hot chicks. And sadly, evolutionarily speaking, you're right, complete dead end. The satyrs were making much better time with all the females just by being unrepentant horn dogs. Clearly they didn't need the whole display, but you know, when you're a leprechaun, you know, you don't have quite the assets that maybe the satyrs do. You need a little something else going on, and as a result, of course, human beings found out the whole rainbow pot of gold connection, and very quickly nearly decimated the leprechaun population, much like we did with the woolly mammoths and all the others. So sadly, it's mankind bringing about the end of a beautiful, beautiful endangered species. Sad, really. Number 49, from Zimnipot. Zim says, you wake up early on a rainy Saturday morning in early April and find yourself in control of an army of 1 million animated gingerbread men. How would you use this army to take over the world? All right. First off, why would you assume that I would want that army to take over the world? Because generally I wouldn't. I have no need to take over the world. And even if I did, here's the real problem. You specify a rainy Saturday morning in early April. You're already giving me the massive handicap. It's April. I don't know what April is like in Sweden, Zim, but here it's rainy. All right? My gingerbread men, while there are a million of them, are even on the best day, good dry weather, they're not going to get stale, they're not going to get, all right, even on the absolute best day, I think one unarmed, unarmored human being who understands that he's dealing with animated gingerbread men could probably take out, 50 or 60,000 of them by himself. All right, this is they're not much of a challenge, and I was going to say they have some problems getting over steps and other stuff, but gingerbread men actually probably would be pretty good at forming gingerbread pyramids to climb up. They would assist each other along the way, but really their biggest weakness, yet rain, dude, they're done. It's not even going anywhere. You know, seriously, actually, the one dude who I said could take out 50 or 60,000 of them, oh, yeah, if he had the wherewithal to just go grab the garden hose, yeah, he could hold them all at bay all by himself. They're pretty much done for. So really, at this point, I'm just going to take my gingerbread men and use them as personal servants, just creature comforts. I might even rent them out, you know, for as long as they last, you know, a million of them. As long as you tell people be careful with them, you know, there's going to be some attrition, and eventually you'll run out. But in the meantime, dude, you can make a buttload of money renting out your animated gingerbread men. That'd be pretty cool. And I'm assuming since I control them, they would make excellent spies. They would bring back, I would rent them out. People would willingly bring in the little performing animated gingerbread men to their homes. They would have tons of fun with them. And, of course, the gingerbread men would all report back to me. There's got to be a way to make money out of that, too. But take over the world, it's not really much of an army, really. I mean, honestly, when your army can be defeated by, I don't know, a couple sprinklers, yeah, you need some more work. Number 84. This one is from Stan. Stan says, do you buy organic food? No, No, I don't. I mean, a lot of it is, look, there's already enough trouble going to the store and realizing that I can get a dozen Little Debbie oatmeal snack cakes for, you know, $1.39 or whatever they cost, as opposed to a dozen apples, which is going to cost considerably more. That you can get not nutrition, but you can get raw calories. You can fill people up way cheaper buying processed junk than you can buying healthy food, much less buying organic healthy food. And I'm not saying any of this is a good thing, but I'm not convinced that organic is inherently healthier for me. I mean, look, I have a horrible diet. I do not eat well no matter what. I apparently am allergic to green vegetables. I try, but I don't do very well. My kids, however, eat really nicely. My kids, there's one picky eater, but my kids in general, they love fresh fruit. They love fresh vegetables. They love home-cooked meals. They eat pretty well, all right? They eat pretty healthy in general. And I'm willing to spend the extra money for healthy food for my kids. I'm not convinced, really, that organic is going to be that much healthier. I'm not convinced that avoiding genetically engineered foods is going to be that much healthier than supposedly normal organic food. I'm not that worried about organic versus non-organic. It doesn't mean that much to me. And I know there are people who swear by it, but you know what? If I'm getting healthy food into my kids, then I think I'm doing a pretty good job. I'm not going to worry about specifically where it comes from. Maybe I should, but I don't. Number 89. Mr. Serious Paul makes his debut on this show. What is your favorite caliber of handgun? Paul, I don't have one. I don't. I love shooting guns. If I get a chance to go out and shoot some targets, I will absolutely do it. I'm not a hunter, never been hunting, don't care. I have nothing against hunting, and I have nothing against eating meat. I love meat, but I'm just not a hunter. But I love shooting guns, and I especially take me out skeet shooting, give me a shotgun, I take me out skeet shooting, love it. As far as a favorite, look, I'm just happy that someone invited me along and lets me play their games, okay? Because I don't own any guns myself. And so therefore, when we do go out, you know, I pitch in to help pay for ammunition or help pay for the Blue Rock or whatever, because, you know, that stuff's expensive, dude. But favorite, I don't have that much experience to be able to tell you which one feels best in my hand. I like getting a chance to play around with them. That's all. Number 80. This one comes from Brasky. Oh, God, Brasky. All right. Tell me a 10-word story. Go! Oh, I can't just go. This is... All right. A 10-word story. Hey, you know what? You know what my favorite 6-word story is? This is the same one everyone else has heard. My favorite 6-word story, I can't remember who came up with it. I think it might have been Hemingway for all I know. It doesn't make any difference. When tasked with coming up with a 6-word story, whatever famous author came up with for sale baby shoes never worn. That's my favorite. I love that one. Because in 6 words conveys tons of information, which of course was the whole point of the exercise. So similarly, a 10-word story. All right. I'm going to go sci-fi. Because I always do. So, time. All right, give me a minute. Just be patient. Okay, this is not as easy as it looks. All right, how about this one? All right, I got it. And I have to count on my fingers, so it'll be a little stilted. I killed my grandfather. Why is my time machine still here? Ooh, that's 11. All right, wait. All right, I killed my grandfather. How is time machine still here? Hey, that's 10. All right, I'm good. Woo! Go me. Number 70 from Serious Paul. Paul asks, what would the podcast smell like if it had a scent? God, have I not done this one before? Were you not listening to the opening of the show? It's Mountain Dew and Cheetos, dude. Best smelling podcast on the internet. I tell you that every week or every couple of weeks. All right. But seriously, if you could actually smell this podcast, all joking aside, you'd realize that it smells like patchouli. Seriously. It smells like peat moss and ass, but with a hint of vanilla. So, you know, takes the edge off. 28. Zimney Pot. Zimney says, why isn't phonetic spelled the way it sounds? Okay, I don't know what letters mean to you in Swedish, Zim, but in English, phonetic actually is pretty close. I mean, PH is pronounced that makes the F sound. That's just the way. I mean, sure, there might be similar spellings for phonetic, but pretty much this is it. Although, if you want the real answer of why don't we have a standardized spelling system in English, because English is awesome. And the things about English that make it so awesome, the fact that we have borrowed, I've given this rant on this podcast a million times, but the fact that we have borrowed words from every culture and every language we've ever run across, that we just assimilate whatever it is we need. We're like the Borg, dude. We just make it all happen, and we put it together, and it's whatever conveys our meaning best, and we will take from anywhere if it helps us. And it makes English a beautiful, powerful language, but it also, that strength, also means that English is one of the biggest pains in the ass to learn in the world. The thing is horrible. There is no standardized spelling for anything. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that, yeah, okay, you can make out, you can sound out a lot of simple words. If you know the phonics of it, you can sound out a lot of stuff, but even some of our simple stuff doesn't work out. And our grammar, our slang, the various idioms that we use, the borrowed words, we are not consistent in any way, and spelling is the absolute worst in English, and that's why phonetic is not spelled the way it sounds. I'm sorry, dude, but I love the language anyway, and I'm willing to take those flaws, which is easy for me to say. I'm a good speller, so for those of you who struggle, I apologize, because I know it's a bitch. It really is. Number 96. Oh, this one comes from Dire Cat. Hey, Cat. On a scale of 1 to Bobby Fischer, how good are you at chess? Ah, dude. 3. I am not good at chess at all. I don't know what it is about chess. It is the kind of game that I really should be good at. I was a very classic nerd in junior high and high school. I learned chess at an early age. I've never enjoyed chess the way some other people have. I mean, I'll play a game and I'll enjoy it in general, but the whole getting good at it thing, the ability to look several moves ahead, I don't know if I'm just too short-sighted, I don't know if I just get bored easily. I've just never been really good at doing that in chess. Just not. I mean, again, I know how to play. I can set up a game. I can have some fun playing it. But as far as being good at it in any way, not really. Not really. I just have fun. Number 50. From Brasky again. Brasky says, is Cabin in the Woods a horror movie? Yes, of course Cabin in the Woods is a horror movie. It is. Look, despite the fact that it is structured to be a meta comment on horror movies in general, and that it does this whole ironic thing and it comments on itself, it is still in the best tradition. It is still a horror movie in and of itself. That's the best way to do a movie like this. If you are going to comment on the genre, then you also have to be true to the genre at the same time. Otherwise, you're just a scary movie, and that's, nobody wants to see that crap. And does Cabin in the Woods offer up some genuine scares and some really horrifying stuff? Absolutely it does. All right, this is spoiler alert. I'm just going to start giving stuff away, but not much. Towards the end, when everybody in the control room is celebrating because we think we've gotten it done, and then in the background, the fight is still going on. It's there, larger than life on the video screen behind them, and that fight is still going on behind them. But, you know, the outcome of that fight is not relevant to them because they've accomplished what they need to accomplish. But as we're watching them celebrate and party and make their little jokes and pay off their bets and everything else, the audience is still, we are horrifically aware of what's going on in the background, and we are watching that, every little snippet of that fight that we see, and every brutal slam and punch and horrifying scare, and we're sucked into it. That's genius, absolute genius, that yes, we've got the meta story, and we realize that the meta story is this huge deal, and this is what this movie is about, and yet we're all still sucked into that character and that girl, and still, when she gets slammed into the dock, it's brutal. It hurts your ribs, and you're watching it, and you're feeling for it, and you're hoping. Still, even though it's not relevant to the meta story, man, at least we don't think it is at this point, we're all still rooting for her to get away. We're all still concerned about her and hoping that something good comes out of this. We're sucked right into it, dude. And that's why Joss Whedon was a genius on this film. It was absolutely wonderful. So yes, absolutely a horror film. Cabin in the Woods. Alright, number 8. This will be our last one. Number 8 comes from Billy Bob. Billy Bob says, name brand or generic? Oh, please, generic. Every chance I can get, generic. Oh, there's an option for it, generic. I can't even, and most of the time, the difference in price is considerable. I mean, usually the difference in price, at least where I shop, difference in price will be like a good 25 to 40% difference, if not more than that. But let me tell you what, with flu season here, and my wife just had viral bronchitis, which was horrible, lasted forever. Mucinex has been our friend around here, as it's probably been everybody's friend around this country. Mucinex is wonderful stuff. And so I go out to buy some Mucinex, and we wanted specifically Mucinex DM, so it's got the cough stuff in it, and the 12-hour formula. All right, this is what I want. And I go over to my local grocery, and there it is. There's the label for it on the shelf, and unfortunately, the generic is gone. It's all sold out because everyone's doing the same thing I am. So there is no generic 12-hour Mucinex DM on the shelf. But if it had been there, it would have been $5.99. That's for the bottle of like 40, I think. And I would have been thrilled with that. No, it was a bottle of 50 for $5.99. All right, right next to it on the shelf, what they do still have is the name brand, the name brand 12-hour Mucinex DM with 40 pills in it, so 10 less pills, and instead of $6, $27. Holy crap! I'm like, yeah, you know what? I love my wife, but I'm going to go do some comparison shopping and see if I can't find the generic somewhere else in town. Wound up going to two or three other places. And ultimately, I still wound up having to buy name brand, but I wound up getting it from Walmart where, yeah, I still paid three times what I should have paid for the generic, but at least I wasn't paying five times as much. Good Lord. I mean, honestly, the difference between 50 pills for $6, 40 pills for 27, that is the most grossly outrageous difference between name brand and generic I've ever seen. And again, they all have to meet up with the same minimum standards, and so they all have to contain exactly the same medicine. I'm not worried about generic. That doesn't bother me in the least. And so therefore, yeah, I'll gladly pay $6 as opposed to 27. The name brand doesn't mean that much to me.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2013 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week is Weezer's in the Garage. And what was that other one? Oh, yeah, Books by They Might Be Giants. These songs are available on iTunes. Check them out. Buy them. Enjoy them. I wouldn't put them in my podcast if I didn't love them. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write me a nice review. You can check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. Stop by Facebook page, click like. It's 9 seconds out of your day. You can do that for me. Don't forget to check out the free games I have available on my free games page. It's a Game, Animal Ball Melee, Sandbox Hill, and 2/3 of a dozen others, all free, all the time. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com, and I promise I'll actually try and respond to you. But to be totally honest, the very best way to talk to me is come sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up, send me a message, we'll hang out, we'll have fun. Bango, number 31. This one comes from Stan. Stan says, what's the name of those crazy books where characters fight by calling out moves and finding what page to go to? Those are the Lost World books. Have you ever played the World War I dogfighting version? I didn't even know there was a World War I dogfighting version. No, of course I haven't. That would be awesome. But hey, if you guys can find the Lost Worlds books, absolutely get them. I probably have talked about them here before, but I tell you what, Lost Worlds is awesome. All right, so you get... you get your man with sword and shield in chainmail. You get your goblin with shield and mace. And then you pit each other, you pit your characters against each other. So if I'm the goblin, I hand you my goblin book and then hold on to my little goblin character sheet. And likewise, you hold on to your little man in chainmail character sheet and you hand me your book. And now we pick our moves. So I'm going to pick an opening charge and you're going to pick a swing high. And then I say, okay, charge, 50, and you say, swing high, 84, or whatever the number is. And then we cross-reference in our little book, and it tells you what page you go to. And now, you see a picture of me charging, and no, actually, you don't see a picture of me charging, because if you swing high while I'm charging, I'm going to see a picture of you swinging high, and you're going to see a picture of me taking a massive head wound, because you're going to catch me in the temple as I charge right into your weapon. And so then you tell me how many hit points I lose, and then, okay, now we have restrictions that, all right, you've been wounded, so you can only do green and yellow next turn. And I tell you, well, since you swung high, you can only do red and orange next turn. And then we balance it out, so we pick our new moves, we cross-reference, we go to the next page. Whoever runs out of hit points first dies, and it's so much fun. I love this thing. In fact, my son's friend Scree, who also listens to this podcast, he's contributed to the Podomatics many times. Scree apparently just got a whole ton of Lost Worlds books for Christmas because he loved ours so much. My sons take them with them whenever they go on band trips or speech or whatever. If they've got a long bus trip ahead of them, they take a stack of Lost Worlds books with them and everyone plays it on the bus and they have an awesome time with it. They're so good. The originals are my absolute favorites, the ones that are all basic... basic D&D style characters. You get the man in plate, the man in chainmail, the woman with quarterstaff, the halfling, there's a dwarf, there's a barbarian, a goblin, a lizard man, there's a whole list of these, and they're all about the same number of hit points, all roughly the same size, and they all match up pretty well when you do this. Then there's also extra ones for, there's dragons and unicorns, and there's a giant, and then death is in there, a wraith. It's not death, but I always call it death when I see the book. Some of them fit in, some of them are a little overpowered, and so they have extra rules for how to fight if you've got 3 books or 4 books and everyone's all fighting each other. I don't care for those as much. I really just don't have as much fun playing that. I would rather just do the one-on-one, off you go. It's really the world's most complicated game of rock, paper, scissors, and it's a ton of fun. You cannot go wrong playing Lost Worlds. According to Scree, who got a bunch of them for Christmas, there's a whole ton of them that I've never seen before. I have all the originals or reprints of the originals, which came out when I was a kid. So these all came out in probably the early 80s, maybe late 70s. So they are old, old. And I have a bunch of those, and that's what I play with. But apparently they've been reprinted. And in addition to reprints, there are now some companies that are making Lost Worlds compatible books. And so you can actually buy new books that all work in the same system and everything goes together. I can't vouch for how well those mesh with everything else. But Gygax and Scree tell me they're actually pretty darn cool. So I had a great time. Didn't even know that there was a World War I dogfighting version. But if I ever have a chance to play it, I will certainly jump on that because I love the concept. I love the Lost Worlds concept. You can sit down, even if you've got a whole ton of people there, you got a bunch of boats, people can kind of pair up. And so you play out a battle, and it is, you know, literally anywhere from 2 to 7 minutes. You know, they're super quick. You play out your battle super quick, and hey, all right, you won, I won, it doesn't make any difference. We can play the same books, we can trade, we can go, you know, go back to the pile and pick out something different. You've got a ton of variety. It's just a great, great little party game. We love it. Absolutely love it.